Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
Tropical storm Ida tears across America's southern states. We're on the ground in hard-hit Louisiana, and I speak to the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi. Then, the chaotic evacuation of Afghanistan nears its end. But what now for the refugees who have fled their homeland? I'm joined by the head of one immigrant resettlement agency who is helping Afghans. Plus, striking a defiant note, my conversation with the founder and a student of the Afghanistan National Institute of Music.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Bianca Goladriga in New York, sitting in for Christian Amanpour, who will be back tomorrow. The lights are out in New Orleans. Power is down across the entire city and swaths of Louisiana in the wake of Hurricane Ida, which left a trail of devastation. Ida hit Louisiana at a time when COVID cases are surging, adding extra pressure to hospitals. In a cruel coincidence, the state was struck on the 16th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. Ida has now been downgraded to a tropical storm as it continues its charge across the United States. Nadia Romero is on the ground in New Orleans, and she gives us a look at some of the damage there.
You can see the destruction behind me. Let's take a walk as we go down the street, which is normally a very nice neighborhood, but it's just been trashed by all of these trees. And this here, you can see this lamp here that's slanted over on top of this car. You can also see these power lines. This is the reason why we have more than a million people without power all across Louisiana. And it's also why many of them will remain without power for at least a couple of days, if not weeks, because there's an order of how they have to do things. So first you have to wait for the storm to pass. We've made it to that mark. Now day two is going out and assessing the damage, and then you have to clear the debris. So what will it take? What kind of equipment will you need to move these power lines, move this car out of the way, move these big trees, these palm trees that are on the ground?
Just devastating images. Our thanks to Nadia Romero on the ground there. And as it moved inland today, Ida brought down trees and power lines across Mississippi. Joining me now is the mayor of the state capital, Jackson, Mayor Antar Labumba. Welcome to the program. Thank you so much for taking time out of it. It's a very busy day for you. I know that you've declared a state of emergency there. What is the situation on the ground in Jackson?
Well, first and foremost, thank you for having me, Bianca, and thank you for inquiring about the status of my city. Presently, we've been experiencing consistent rain. The wind has increased over the last few hours, and we have residents who have experienced power outages sporadically across the city. There are some areas where there are down tree limbs and down power lines, but as it stands at this present moment, we have not seen any catastrophic events.
The storm has been downgraded, but no one should be fooled by its wrath and some of the damage that it could ensue. We're talking about wind gusts that could be 70 to 90 miles per hour. What are you most concerned about, especially when you see the images out of New Orleans, which is a city that is dark right now?
Well, I want our residents to be aware that a tropical storm can still administer pretty severe damage to a city. We're still concerned about flooding potentially taking place within our city, particularly around the flood-prone areas. And we're concerned about potential debris that may be associated with those high winds. We're advising our residents that they should not go into standing water, don't walk, swim, or drive in that standing water. And we're asking that any resident that lives in a flood-prone area that they seek higher ground. And that has been our advice over the last couple of days. We've been issuing sandbags since yesterday morning, and we continue to have our public works, our police department, and our fire departments out, not only assessing danger, but trying to mitigate the threats.
As of now, though, no signs of major power outages, correct?
Well, we have sparse power outages across the city, but as it stands presently, the majority of our residents still have power. We know that we're not out of the woods yet, and so we're maintaining the discipline that we've asked our residents to maintain throughout this storm event.
And we are expecting to hear from President Biden on Storm Ida and talking about some of the aftermath there. The images that we've seen are just horrific in parts of Louisiana. I know that you've been in touch with the White House as well. What has that conversation been like? What resources are you asking for, if any?
Well, I'm fortunate to have been invited to a call that will take place shortly. So, I'm grateful that the White House is concerned about the impacts across the coastal states. To date, I don't know what that conversation will entail, but I want to be supportive and continue to ask for resources that help support not only our residents in the midst of this storm, but make certain that we build ourselves to be more resilient going forward. As it has been well documented, the city of Jackson has a very fragile infrastructure, particularly as it pertains to our water infrastructure. And so, fortunately, we have not experienced any devastating impact to that infrastructure thus far, but it is always a critical, we're always in a critical state as it pertains to our water distribution systems.
I was gonna ask you about infrastructure because I know that pipes throughout the city froze during a winter storm recently, and you are concerned about the water supply now. What is your message to residents? Should they be conserving that water now?
Well, we have not received any information of water pressure being decreased at this time. We have asked our residents to store up not only potable but non-potable water in anticipation for this storm. Thus far, our infrastructure is holding up. However, that can change in a moment's notice. If that takes place, then as our public works crews are out, not only will they be making necessary repairs, but we will look at distribution efforts in terms of water if that becomes necessary.
And this crisis obviously happening as the country continues to battle with COVID, and your state is included in that battle. What is the hospital situation like there right now, given this storm? Are you prepared for patients that may come and citizens that may come in the aftermath of the storm, as well as those that are now dealing with COVID?
Well, no pun intended, what this creates is a perfect storm of events taking place. Having our hospitalization rate already at its critical levels, we're concerned about that. We're continuing to maintain communication with not only our county, but state administrators, and hoping that they provide information and relief to our residents. We could ill afford to have a catastrophic event that leads to more calls or more individuals being taken to the hospital. But this is an area of concern, great concern for us in the city. Jackson not only services the residents of our own city, we are the capital of healthcare for the Central Mississippi District. And so we're praying for the safety and praying that residents in surrounding areas adhere to the advice that has been provided to them, so that we don't see unnecessary injury.
We are praying for you as well, Mayor Lubumba. I heard the sirens behind you reminding us once again that you are in a state of emergency. Best of luck to you and your residents there. We will continue to be following this story and check in with you later. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, while the U.S. mounts an effort to control the damage at home, in Afghanistan, the chaos continues. As many as five rockets were fired at Kabul Airport just this morning. What you're seeing now is the car reportedly used as a platform for those rockets. They were intercepted by a U.S. defense system. Meantime, CNN has been told that 10 members of one family, mostly children, were killed in a U.S. drone strike that targeted a suspected ISIS-K suicide bomber. Well, all this sets the scene with just a day left until President Biden's evacuation deadline. Joining me now for the latest is Mike Rogers, a former U.S. congressman and chairman of the Select Committee on Intelligence. Thank you so much, Mike, for joining us. We appreciate it. Let me get your thoughts on what's concerning you most in these final hours as the U.S. evacuates and meets that August 31st deadline.
Well, it really, today, it's two things. One is the terrorist attacks targeted at not just Americans, but our Western allies and other Afghans who were cooperative with the West. And then the second part of that is there is this unbelievable outside of government effort to try to get these people rescued and out. These are people who are on Taliban kill lists, who have their families threatened to have their daughters into forced marriages and other things. And there's this mad scramble. And I have to tell you, I have pretty good acuity into many of these organizations. Most former government folks, special forces, intelligence, other, who had just answered the call and on their own with their own finances. And, you know, I know my wife is heavily involved in this as well, trying to get these people to safety best they can and out of the country. So all of those, both of those things are the things I worry about today. And I just want to tip my hat to the Brits and the French, who have been exceptionally good about trying to go and get people that worked with them out and people that they believe are high value individuals who need to be candidly rescued from the Taliban wrath that we know is coming.
Yeah, and I'll be speaking with the head of an organization that is helping resettle some of those refugees right after our conversation. But from a military and a terrorism standpoint, you know, we mentioned those five rockets that were thwarted and fired at the Kabul airport today. I'm wondering, does a diminished U.S. footprint on the ground there impact the caliber of intelligence that we're able to gather in these remaining hours?
Absolutely. So here's what happened over time that shrunk our ability to collect intelligence. The U.S. and the NATO efforts kind of abandoned the eastern provinces, you know, places like Assadabad and Jalalabad and others, for that big, robust intelligence collection platforms that we had going to make sure that those places didn't get infiltrated by Al-Qaeda or Taliban or others. Well, when that pull down began to happen, they lost some bits of intelligence, key pieces of intelligence along the way. So the closer it kind of contracted to the cities in the bigger provinces and Kabul, the worse the intelligence got. So once you pulled this plug, the notion that we'll have this robust intelligence network that is going to give us real-time actionable intelligence is just candidly doesn't jive with reality. And so that worries me a lot. But you're already seeing this petri dish of terrorism kind of growing from Al-Qaeda to other terrorist groups, ISIS, and not just ISIS-K, but that ISIS extremism mentality. And remember, a lot of people abandoned Al-Qaeda when they saw ISIS doing well in Syria. You'll see that crossing back and forth. The Taliban, ISIS, and Al-Qaeda, despite what you hear, they have more in common with their extremist ways than they do the West. So there's going to be changes in ways people say, oh, they won't work with X or they won't do. I would not take any of that to the bank.
And unfortunately, collateral seems to be just a reality of war, right? And even though the U.S. tries to avoid injuring, harming, killing innocent civilians, I do want to get your response to the reports that CNN is hearing about 10 civilians who were killed in this drone strike, obviously the target being a car that had been packed with bombs and explosives headed for the Kabul airport that had been sent by and orchestrated by ISIS-K. CNN's reporting that there are upwards of 10 innocent civilians, seven of them may be children. They are claiming that they're not affiliated with ISIS-K. Is this just a mistake in terms of intelligence or communications or unfortunate chain of events in combat?
So let me do a couple of things, and I'll tell you why. So I did every single after-action report as chairman of the Intelligence Committee on airstrikes that targeted terrorist targets across that region. And what the sometimes was reported, I know for a fact, was completely inaccurate about civilian casualties. So my first answer to that is I'm going to be skeptical of that level of civilian death. That serves the purpose of the people who may or may not have put children in there, or if there are any children there at all, number one. So I think a little more needs to be fleshed out on that. Number two, we are seeing the Taliban use women and children as shields as they're working up to the Panjshir region of the country where that old Northern Alliance is kind of forming. So we're seeing them use that very tactic in other places. That's the Taliban, by the way, and this may be ISIS. They all understand that civilians will make the United States wave off in most cases. And that could have happened here as well, but the fact that there were explosives headed to kill Americans may have outweighed any risk. But again, the first question I have is, I'm not sure I believe the numbers until they're confirmed by the U.S. government or one of our Western allies, if that many civilians, if any at all, candidly, were killed in that blast.
Yeah, and the Pentagon spokesperson today just noted that there were reports of civilian casualties, but wouldn't go into any greater detail. Can I just get your thoughts on the current situation of, for lack of a better phrase, strange bedfellows? Now, the U.S. Having to work with the Taliban now. One reporter last week, I thought, pegged it well, comparing it to the TSA, the Taliban being America's TSA at Kabul airport. Can we trust them? And if we can't, is this sort of an act of desperation on our parts? I mean, it does seem to be quite a strange predicament for the U.S. to be in.
And unfortunately, we put ourselves in this predicament. We had opportunities not to have this happen. You have to remember something. We were still treating the Taliban as a terrorist organization weeks before this and months in certain airstrikes that the Afghan army that we would support, the United States and NATO would support against Taliban targets because they were still listed as terrorists. So any notion somehow overnight we've decided that they're a legitimate government that has a 75,000 person army that's well trained and disciplined, none of those things are true. None of them. And remember, the reason the Taliban came out, I think it was last week, and said, well, women, you need to stay home, not because we won't let you go back to work at some point, but our soldiers need to understand how to treat women first, meaning they can't control all of the elements. And it's pretty diverse. And your levels of extremism are all over the map. Most of them certainly extreme over to the point where we would all call them terrorism. So these are the people that we've said, oh, okay, you know, the people who are stoning women, who are telling women they can't go past the sixth grade in an education, that that they have to stay home, they can't work, and are committing atrocities. And by the way, they're raiding houses in Kabul now for people and doing summary executions. All of that we know is happening. And somehow we've decided, well, they're a legitimate government and they want international recognition so we can trust them. I ask you, would you put your son and daughter on that fence line trusting a Taliban terrorist soldier for their life and limb? I think no normal rational person would say yes. And so this is a disaster of epic proportion. And again, there's going to be real lives that are lost in this. Certainly our U.S. Marines, thank you for their service and God bless their families. But think of all the people who are now terrified that once the West has left, that all of these people that we promised that we would be there for are standing there with face to face with Taliban hatred and terrorism. I mean, this is as bad as an event as we can possibly, I think we could possibly see right now.
Yeah, you asked me that hypothetical question. The first thing that comes to mind are the families, the parents of those 13 brave American servicemen and women whose lives were lost trying to rescue and save others, and wondering if they are asking the same question as well. You mentioned our allies and giving praise to them for doing all that they could to rescue Afghans and other civilians who had helped them during these 20 years. I want to get your take on the UN Security Council that is scheduled to meet and vote today on a potential resolution that would establish somewhat of a safe passage zone to allow more of these Afghans to travel freely if, they, in fact, their lives are at risk, or if they were part of the SIVs and the groups of those who had helped and assisted NATO members. Do you think this is a good solution to a bad situation?
It could be a good solution to a bad situation, but you have to be able to enforce it. Remember, the Taliban is already causing problems through these checkpoints. We've heard stories, and again, there are groups working to move people inside the country, really sensitive stuff, trying to get around Taliban checkpoints and whatnot. And we know for a fact that their documents have been confiscated, that there have been beatings and other things trying to discourage people from moving. So I don't, you know, again, now we've made it so the Taliban gets a vote on this. So I don't, you know, the UN Security Council, that's great. But if they don't enforce it, if we don't have some way to enforce that route and an ability for these people and families who have risked their lives in support of a free, you know, Afghanistan that is more stable and more secure and does is not a safe haven for Al-Qaeda, well, then nothing's going to happen other than the Taliban's going to intimidate them from getting to these routes. And if you look at what just happened, boy, you got to be a little bit skeptic that they're going to be able to do that. I hope they do. It would be great. I know the people on the ground who literally haven't slept for 5 days trying to make all of these things happen. I think they'd be appreciative of some route and some way to get these people out.
Yeah. And if history is any indication, in the past UN safe zones in Sarajevo, I think of some of past battles, they ended up being moot, right? And so many lost their lives because they didn't have the enforcement of other nations and NATO allies. You know, it's hard not to politicize in this environment here in the U.S., and I want to just get your honest assessment, not as a Republican, not as a Democrat, but as somebody who's an expert in this field, how this could have been done better, because President Biden does have a point that this was a deal that was arranged by his predecessor, and his argument, and we will never know, we've already lost 13 U.S. service members, is that more could have been lost if he tore this deal up. So how could this have been handled better?
Yeah. First of all, my advice to President Biden in the beginning of this is the first thing you do is go back and say, new president, need more time. And again, I'm one that believe we should have had a presence there for an enduring peace, by the way. But OK, let's say that we lost that fight and we needed to pull out. You can't just pull the plug like this without coordination of your allies. So we gave up the one place that he did not have to do that. I would argue you needed to keep that, which is Bagram Air Base. That's where we ran all our, a vast majority of our counterterrorism operations came out of there, meaning that's what was keeping the Taliban back. And there are reports now, and I don't know if the validity of these, that the Taliban actually offered to stay out of Kabul until we could get everyone out. I don't know if that's true or not. If that was and they didn't take it, that's malfeasance. We should have said, yep, that's right. And by the way, not give up Kabul to the very, very end. We should have had two airports running, and that way you could have secured both and got people out, I think, in a way that was rational. The second part, remember when they closed Kabul, Bagram Air Base, they didn't tell anyone. Literally, the guards at the gates turned around and we were gone. I mean, you can't tell us that they're allies and then have them standing there not having a clue that we just left in the middle of the night. And by the way, that was that psychological blow that hit troops all over the country, because everybody knew that medevac came from there, logistics was coordinated there, and counterterrorism activities were coordinated from there. So once that thing went, people started thinking, uh-oh, this thing is bad. And then it just deteriorated like very, very, very quickly. So that's the way I would have done it, because we don't really control the perimeter of the airport. We control inside the fence line of the airport. That's not controlling the airport in Kabul, which is why we saw the unfortunate tragedy with our 13 Marines and 170 innocent civilians were killed.
Yeah, well, Mike Rogers, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your work and helping those SIVs there in Afghanistan trying to get out to freedom and safety as well. And let's hope that these final hours are safe as the U.S. Finally leaves their mission there after 20 years. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, right. Listen, I'm just supporting my wife. She tells me, go do that. Why, she's manning the phone. She's doing great.
Smart man. Thank your wife for us.
Yes, I will.
Take care.
Thank you.
Well, now the French government announced the end of its Kabul evacuation mission Friday, having pulled out nearly 3,000 people since August 15th, according to the French Foreign Ministry. Among those evacuated, interpreters and people who helped the French army with logistics. Correspondent Melissa Bell follows one Afghan refugee in Paris who spent sleepless nights helping to evacuate his fellow Afghans from afar.
The very last French evacuation out of Kabul. It left without incident, but for those on board, Afghans that NATO had promised to help, it had been a frantic fight to find someone who could get them into the airport. An angel who might well be on the other side of the world.
Reza Jafari has barely slept since Kabul fell. It's 6 a.m. in the little corner of Afghanistan that he's created in northern Paris. From here, he normally helps Afghan asylum seekers arriving in France. But he tells me that the chaos of Kabul led him to jump into a new role as an unofficial crisis coordinator.
Through WhatsApp groups, a map of Kabul airport and pin locations, Reza Jafari connected from Paris those eligible for evacuation who sent him pictures of themselves and their locations to help connect them with French officials on the other side of the fence. French diplomatic sources have confirmed his crucial role in helping people like Zahra Husseini, who spent 3 days outside the airport. Reza explains that she wasn't well. She'd sent this photo saying that she might die if she didn't get help.
Group WhatsApp messages upon which life and death hangs. CNN has changed the names for security reasons. My parents are out, asks one desperate woman. Please help them. In another, Abdul has disappeared, says one person stuck outside. We are alone at the canal. Abdul is inside, replies a French official.
The canal marks the spot where the meetings happen, near Abbey Gate, the site of Thursday's suicide attack.
Those who reach the other side, says Reza, are saved. By Monday afternoon, Zahra Husseini's group crossed the canal, met their contact, and reached safety. Reza's journey has brought him to this door. He knows all too well the heartache and hope of finding refuge. It's his connection to those he's helped. Thank God that you all escaped hell, he says. But there are other friends who are still stuck. Zahra Husseini says she can't believe that she knew war as a young girl and still now as an old woman. She says she's happy to be released from the pressure of the Taliban, but so sad to have left her homeland, her children, her friends, and her beloved Afghanistan. Mixed emotions that are shared by the evacuees and the man who helped bring a group of strangers to safety, with the images on their phones still etched indelibly on their minds.
There will be hundreds of thousands of stories similar to that one. Thank you, Melissa Bell, for reporting. Well, many people trying to leave Afghanistan will be left behind come that August 31st deadline, tomorrow. Today, the Pentagon said the State Department will continue working to get them out.
For Americans and other individuals that want to be able to leave Afghanistan after our withdrawal is complete, that the State Department is going to continue to work across many different levers to facilitate that transportation. As I said earlier, right now we do not anticipate a military role in that effort.
For those lucky enough to be evacuated, a tough road lies ahead. Already officials are saying that at least 34 unaccompanied Afghan children have arrived in the United States. Some have been reunited with family in the country. Joining me on this now is Mark Hetfield, president of the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, HIAS, a nonprofit that provides humanitarian assistance to refugees worldwide. Mark, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for joining us. I really wanted to have this conversation with you because, rightly so, for the past few weeks, we've been focusing on step one, and that is getting as many Afghans, obviously the American citizens there, but as many Afghan SIVs and those who helped NATO allies out of the country as possible. Now that that so many are leaving, we're into step two. What happens when they are resettled? How are they resettled? And that's where you step in. What is your organization currently doing?
Thanks, Bianna. Well, the main thing we're doing right now is preparing for the arrival of those who are coming and the resettlement and the integration of those who are already here and in the various military bases getting processed as parolees.
And for those tens of thousands, I don't even know what that number is. I mean, let's just say, first off, kudos and hats off to the U.S. mission for evacuating. I think the number is 122,000. That's Americans as well as Afghan allies there. But for those who remain, how arduous is their process going to be if they can flee?
Well, that's the problem, is that there really is no process, right? I mean, they should have announced the pullout with already having a plan in place to have a process, but there is no process. So now people just have to get somehow the attention of the various forces that are doing these evacuations. It's really difficult. There is no process whatsoever.
And how realistic is continuing this process from over the horizon? You just heard from the Pentagon spokesperson, John Kirby, that this will not involve U.S. military. How on earth can this happen then?
Yeah, that's what we're asking ourselves too, Bianca. We're asking ourselves a lot of questions. We have a lot more questions than we have answers right now. I don't know how it's going to work. None of us know. The Afghans who were stuck there, the Afghans who laid their lives down, risked their lives to support U.S. troops, don't know either. The evacuation, the completion of the troop withdrawal was supposed to be this week. It was heartening to hear the news in the last segment that the U.N. is meeting today, the Security Council, to have a safe zone. But let's hope that safe zone works, and let's hope that it is enforced. Because right now, there's really no process for evacuation.
And that's where organizations like yours step in. I know that you'd been in touch with the White House and the administration on efforting for these Afghans and these refugees to resettle in the United States. Explain how that process works. You are an organization that, by the way, is over 120 years old. You have aided refugees going back over a century now. What role do you play, and where does your money come from, and how much money are you able to give these Afghan families?
Well, that's a lot of questions, Bianca, but I'll try to answer them. Well, one is that there are nine agencies like HIAS. We are the Jewish community's refugee agency, but there are eight other agencies. Six of us are faith-based. Three of us are secular. And so all of us are working to prepare. We've been told by the Department of State to prepare for 50,000 parolees. These are people who are in the SIV process, the special immigrant visa process, the Afghans who risked their lives for the United States forces there, but who were not able to complete that 14-step process in Afghanistan. So they are coming over here to complete that process. Most of them are being housed in military bases around the country. I have staff deployed at a number of those bases helping with their paperwork and their orientation. Once they've completed those stages, they will move to communities across the country with the assistance of the nine resettlement agencies, including HIAS. In many of these communities, they will have some ties because they served alongside of Americans and other Afghans have preceded them. So they will be joining with those community members when they go to these new towns and cities. But in terms of our funding, right now there is... Normally, we get federal funding for refugees. We are going to get some federal funding for this population, but the U.S. doesn't have a mechanism to do that for people who are paroled into the United States. So we're getting a little bit over $1,000 per special immigrant from the United States government.
Yeah, and you're talking about a little over $1,000 in assistance per Afghan parolee in this day and age. That doesn't get you very far. You wrote an op-ed, and you weren't really holding back, and you invoked some of the points that you've already made with me here. How did we get here? So many questions to be asked about why this process wasn't expedited sooner. And you talk about the 1968 Refugee Convention and laws in place that should have avoided these situations, obviously not trying to repeat history after we saw the St. Louis turned around. These were 900 German Jews in 1939 who had fled Europe, hoping to either come to the U.S. or Cuba. And yet we're still seeing this bureaucracy and red tape and unanswered questions as to why more refugees weren't processed.
Yeah, Bianca, I'm glad you raised that because that is what concerns me the most. This is not the first time we've had a large number of refugees leaving on an emergency basis that we have to help. And Congress in 1980 gave the president all the tools that he needs to do such an evacuation with the Refugee Act of 1980. And the fact of the matter is, over the last 40 years, the executive branch has put more and more and more red tape into that process, erected more and more obstacles, weighed down the process to such a point that it can no longer move quickly. It used to be that refugees were brought into this country through this parole process because there was no way for them to come in as refugees. Congress changed that in 1980. Gave this mechanism for refugees to be rescued and resettled here as refugees, but it's too mired down in red tape right now for them to use it that way. So once again, we're relying on parole, which is ill-suited for this, but it's better suited than the refugee program right now. We have to take a hard look at that program and try to make sure that it's once again responsive to an emergency need like what we're facing today.
And it's not just the United States that finds themselves in this situation. A lot of our allies of richer countries like the UK also are not taking in as many as some critics say they should. The United Kingdom, they said they would be taking in, I believe, 20,000 refugees over a span of 5 years. And I spoke with the Albanian prime minister, a small country of only 3 million, one of the poorest countries in Europe, who's taking in upwards of 4,000 or 5,000 refugees. And he told me why they're doing that. And he slightly admonished other richer countries that aren't. Take a listen.
This is a time to think about them who are between life and death. And Albania is not among the richest countries. It's very well known. But we have a memory, and we very strongly believe that it's in the honor of all the NATO members and of all this community of countries that have been promoting by the force of the example and protecting by the examples of force, ideals and values to stand up. Otherwise, we risk to see NATO itself fading away in the eyes of so many people around the world craving for freedom, for democracy, for human rights, for women equal treatment. And not only NATO, but all our part of the world that is based on these values and principles.
Mark, do you agree with him? Is this sort of the defining moment now for NATO to step up?
Oh, absolutely. And this is nothing new. Like 80% of the world's refugees are hosted by developing countries. Albania, of course, is a little further along than most refugee hosting countries. But this is a burden that is not evenly shared at all. And I would also say, so there's two things here. There's the political will that we need to have here in this country and that other countries need as well, particularly in the West. But also we need to have the political will and the authority in this country to make this thing work. And right now in the refugee program, you have no accountability because there is no single agency, there is no single official responsible for the program. Instead, you have Homeland Security, you have the State Department, you have Health and Human Services, you have various intelligence agencies and law enforcement agencies, all of which have a hand in this program that has no leadership at the top. And so what it really needs is leadership, and there needs to be political will to exercise that leadership.
Turkey's president, who took in a lot of refugees following the war in Syria, already said that Turkey will not be the refugee warehouse this time, to quote him. We're seeing backlash in the United States. I don't have to tell you that from certain members of the Republican Party who are accusing some of these immigrants of being terrorists because of their religion, questioning them, not wanting them to come to their areas and their hometowns. And I want to repeat a statistic that, you provided us, and that is that the refugee program, yours, has resettled more than 3.1 million people with no lethal act of terror committed by a single one of them on U.S. soil. So where does this perception come from then, Mark?
Well, I think it's just, frankly, political grandstanding. It's a solution in search of a problem. And, what really upset me was in September of 2015, and actually it was November 13th, 2015, one of the terrorist attacks in Paris, where there was this uproar in the United States of 31 governors and multiple presidential candidates who said that we needed to shut our doors to Syrian Muslim refugees, and 31 states purported to do that. Syrian Muslim refugees had nothing to do with that attack in Paris, absolutely nothing. It was radicalized Europeans. But scapegoating is easy. And so investing all this money in security vetting, in extreme vetting, which takes not only months but years to get through the refugee process, is not a good investment, because it's addressing a risk that we really haven't seen manifest itself in the 40-year history of the program. And yet you want a real security risk, look at all of the military hardware that we're leaving behind in Afghanistan. I'd be a lot more worried about that.
Yeah. And Mark, I would be remiss not to conclude by telling our viewers my own personal connection to your organization. Had it not been for HIAS, my parents and myself would not be in the United States and U.S. citizens. You helped us. We were refugees, political refugees from the former Soviet Union, who came as Jewish refugees in 1980 with the assistance of HIAS. That is my first picture in the United States, my dad and me. And you helped resettle us in Houston, Texas, where the community welcomed us. My parents still live there. And I remember to this day all of the bills that they would write checks to repay HIAS for the plane ticket back. It took them a while, but they managed to put together the money to repay you, and thank you and your organization. And ours is just one of millions of stories. And I was heartened to read of an Afghan family that had resettled in Houston and had been taken to a Walmart over the weekend. And it just made me think of how hospitable some of our cities and communities are, thanks to the help of organizations like yours, Mark. Thank you so much.
And thank you, Bianna. We're very proud of your accomplishments here.
Good luck in your future endeavors, and keep us posted,
thanks.
Okay?
Thanks.
Well, now the evacuation deadline may still be looming, but the Taliban are already imposing harsh restrictions. One Taliban spokesman telling the New York Times that music is forbidden in Islam. We're hoping that we can persuade people not to do such things instead of pressuring them. Well, any ban would be a tough blow to a country with such a rich cultural history. Afghanistan fell silent in 1996 when the Taliban first took power. But since they were ousted in 2001, music returned to the country, in no small part thanks to my next guest, Dr. Ahmad Sarmast, the founder of the Afghanistan National Institute of Music. I spoke with him just before the comments made by the Taliban about music. We were also joined by his student, Zarifa Adiba, who was a conductor in the school's trailblazing all-female Zora Orchestra. They both joined us from outside of Afghanistan. Ahmad and Zarifa, thank you so much for joining us, and welcome to the program. Ahmad, let me tell our viewers a little bit about the school. You opened it in 2010, the Afghanistan National Institute of Music. At its peak, it had 300 students. 35% of that consisted of female students. What is the status of the school today?
The status of the school, as the status of the entire country, is unpredictable. The situation is developing very fast on the ground in Afghanistan, and still we do not know what will be the attitude and the policies of the Taliban towards music in their second time in power. But the past history of the Taliban being in power and their attitude towards music, arts, and culture is not encouraging that we should be hopeful for the future. But still, we hope that as the Taliban are claiming that they have changed, that we should see that change in practice. We should see that they will respect the musical rights and cultural rights of the Afghan people this time.
Music in Afghanistan has really struggled to come to the forefront, and it's something that you have helped bring to the international community with this school over the past 20 years, the two decades since the U.S. invasion there. But there is a rocky history between music and Afghanistan. In particular, the Taliban, music was censored beginning in 1978 after a coup then, and then once again once the Taliban came into play. Zarifa, during that time, you were born in Afghanistan. A year later, your family fled to Pakistan, and you grew up with music in your bones. You had a passion to be a pop star, and instead you turned to classical music. Talk about that experience for you. When did you first develop that passion?
Before going to Anim, I used to think that music is all just singing, because that was how it was represented on televisions, and I used to listen to different pop stars, and I was thinking that, okay, this is all music. You sing lyrics, and there is music background, and then that's how you're going to be the pop star, you know? But then when I was just taking music classes here and there, then I found out about the Afghanistan National Institute of Music, and then I entered and I talked to Dr. Samas, and then there was a process to get into Anim. Then I realized that what music really is, it is more than singing, it's more than lyrics, it's more than performing, you know? So music is just a big ocean. It's a lot in there.
And you worked your way up to being the conductor of the Zora Orchestra, an all-female orchestra. You also play the viola and the violin. Ahmad, you have literally risked your life so that Zarifa and her peers could pursue their passion. Talk about that moment where you almost were killed.
The Afghanistan National Institute of Music and myself have been always on the hit list of the Taliban. And in 2014, during a musical show where my students were playing in the French Institute of Afghanistan, a suicide bomber who was sitting behind my back exploded himself. And that's a tragic incident in the history of the Afghanistan National Institute of Music. It's because two people were killed in a concert hall, a beautiful young journalist and a German man who was sitting next to me. But most importantly, my students got traumatized. The entire audience was traumatized, but it did not end there. And the subsequent statement of the Taliban promised to get after the music school and anyone who promotes music and music education and arts and culture in Afghanistan, which has been considered by the Taliban as an infidel practice or an Islamic practice. And that was there. But in 2015, there was another plan. And in 2017, another group has been arrested that their task was to plan and to establish my road so they can eliminate me. And that was but everything is worth it. And once again, to ensure the musical rights of the Afghan people, to give happiness and smile to a child through your activities, that's the biggest reward that one may desire to have. And I'm very pleased that I played a modest role in the lives of many young people in Afghanistan. And if I manage to make their life different, that's what for I was in Afghanistan.
I think your students would say that you played more than a modest role in their success. Zarifa, your personal story faced challenges as you were growing up as well. I know that there were uncles and members of your family who didn't believe that a girl should be spending her time invested in music and arts and culture. That is one struggle. Talk about the much larger struggle of being surrounded by government officials who also believe the same and may then close the school and potentially risk your own life in pursuing your passion?
Just to be honest, these few days I have been thinking about this, you know, about past few years, the way I have studied music, the way I have been fighting to a very conservative family or conservative society in order to pursue my dreams, in order to play music, in order to perform on the stage. Now, thinking about Taliban coming in Afghanistan, those who think of music as forbidden, those who had destroyed music once upon a time, it's scary to think about it. I cannot think, like, it's just so scary to think about, because we have been, it was not just hard for me, but it was hard for many members of Zora Orchestra, because we were really fighting to like a very to a community, you know, that they are way better than the Taliban. So just to be honest, whenever I start thinking about Taliban being in Afghanistan and about my profession music and about my classmates, it is just, I just cannot come to a point, or I cannot think of a result, or I cannot think what is going to happen. It's just so furious, I can say. I cannot think what's going to happen.
And Ahmad, to follow up on that, you know, Zarifa, you both are fortunate to be out of Afghanistan now. I'm sure that day in and day out, your focus is on those students who remain there.
Currently, the safety and the security of the students, Anim faculty and Anim community, is a top priority. I personally, together with a team of former Anim students and many friends around the world, we do everything absolutely to provide safety and security to my student. This will be followed by the second top priority, which is to begin negotiating, begin talking, and to making sure that the musical rights of the Afghan people is not taken away from their life. And most importantly, to use the soft power of music to transform not only the lives of Afghan children, but at the same time, to make a contribution to the betterment of Afghan society, but also to build bridges between Afghan people, and also to contribute to a long-lasting, just, civil and peace process in Afghanistan. A just peace is when Zarifa is able to get her viola, get on the stage, and perform in front of hundreds of thousands of people. Also, a just peace is when an Afghan children without fear can come to a music school and to benefit from the beauty of music, and also how music can contribute in many ways to the development of a child.
It was an accomplishment in and of itself to open the school and have students in the hundreds join and grow their musical talents and dreams within the country. But we should let our viewers know that you are internationally acclaimed. You have performed in some of the most prestigious music venues and halls throughout the world, in Carnegie Hall, at the Kennedy Center, at the World Economic Forum. What are you most proud of in your, I would say, short history of success, Ahmad?
What I'm proud most, it's not just all these awards that the school received or I received. The most of what I can be proud is when I see Zarifa studying today abroad, and she's the tomorrows of Afghanistan. The most enjoyable success or achievements of the Afghanistan National Institute of Music or myself is the changes that has been brought to the lives of many Afghan boys and girls. The fact that we managed to create an environment in our school which has been called the happiest place in Afghanistan. I'm very proud of a school which has been also identified as a beacon of hope for the country. All the unforgettable achievements, but the people of Afghanistan are capable of standing from the ashes and moving forward.
Zarifa, what do you want the world to know about what music means, not only to you, but to all of your friends and, I would say, millions of Afghan children?
I feel that music can be kind of a route to create peace among all the youth of Afghanistan and all the people and all the ethnicity. Music was, like, I experienced it myself. I have my best friends from different ethnicities in my school. Like, we all were coming from different parts of Afghanistan, and we were sitting in one orchestra, and we were playing music, the same music, and we were trying our best to play it as beautiful as we can. So I think music is a tool to bring all people together, to unite them, to think about humanity, to think about beauty, to think about peace and friendship, and far from war, fight, killing, bomb, and everything. So music is really important in every country. As I said before, it is the identity of us, you know, it is the identity of people, a country. So music can do a lot of things, not just in Afghanistan, but around the world.
You have millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people around the world rooting for that day when music can continue to thrive in Afghanistan. And Zarifa, I hope, and our audience hopes, that we can one day listen to you perform as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we reached out to Zarifa after our interview when the news came of a potential ban on music. She told us that her friends are now breaking their own instruments, fearing what will happen if the Taliban find them. She said, "I just can't imagine my Afghanistan without music. It's heartbreaking." It is heartbreaking. And that is it for now. Thank you so much for watching, and goodbye from New York.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.